On this episode of Video Culture, we'll talk the movies of summer of 1985.
Did you rewind it?
I don't know.
In a time where everyone has a podcast, in a place where everyone has an opinion. Two heroes, Matthew and Ryan, against all odds, are here to save your movie viewing experience from total disaster. Your trip through the video aisles of yesteryear begins now. There will be chills, there will be thrills, and there's a good chance that Ryan will have a coffee spill. They'll discuss the quality, cultural significance, and more detail, frankly, than you bargained for. Here's your host, Ryan Acri and Matthew Essery.
And welcome to the summer of 1985 edition of Video Culture. I'm your host, Ryan Acri.
And I'm Matthew Essery.
And this is the first episode of season three, right?
Yep. Welcome to 2021, guys.
2021, episode number 52. Now, this episode is a kind of a retrospective episode of the movies of the summer of 1985. Last season, we started off season two of talking about the summer movies of 1984. But we thought we would kind of keep with that theme and just kind of talk about the great movies of 1985. I mean, some of these movies we've already actually talked about in previous episodes. We've done, you know, they were one of the two movies that we discussed, and we're just like, God, all these movies came out in 1985. Like, and just look at this list, and that's what we're kind of going to do. And now the rest of the season, of course, we'll do other movies that are not within 1985, right?
Yeah, this is basically just a palate cleanser between season two and season three. Consider this like a one-off kind of thing that we do basically in between seasons, just to kind of reset and get back in the mood to jump into our normal format.
And you know, really, everybody is nostalgic about 1985. You know, it's just a lot of pop culture about it, you know, or about the 80s in general. You know what I mean? I mean, you have the Goldbergs, which is very movie-oriented TV show on ABC. Stranger Things, which is very movie-oriented show on Netflix. Just a lot of things happening really in pop culture that are surrounding like the 80s, really. And just to kind of put ourselves in that mindset of 1985. Here's a few facts about 1985 and where kind of where we were at. The average movie ticket only cost $3.55.
I actually remember paying that much to go to the movies with my dad when I was a kid.
Yeah, it was about $2 or $3. Yeah. The Microsoft Windows 1.0 was released in 1985. And also in March of 15th, 1985, the first .com domain name was registered to Symbolics.com. It still exists today and is now an online internet history museum. So in the one of the biggest news of 1985 was that in April of 85, New Coke was released and promptly discontinued in July 11th of 1985. ABC actually interrupted General Hospital to break the story that New Coke was going away and Classic Coke was coming back.
You know, I don't think I've ever actually had New Coke.
Oh, you haven't? I think Stranger Things had a New Coke kind of promotion where you could buy like a pack where Coke actually made it. They actually formulated it and sold it and had specialized bottles where you could buy it. And yeah, it's really interesting. It all came about because they were switching from sugar to high fructose corn syrup, and they messed with the formula to try to make it better, but people didn't like it. They just wanted their regular Coke back. So when they re-released Classic Coke, it was the same Coke but with corn syrup, but no, nobody really cared.
And this is that episode of podcast, so we're gonna move on. So.
My nerd, you know, pop soda is we'll get turned off here. Actually, all right. So the Titanic was also found in 1985. The Nintendo Entertainment System was also released in late 1985. And one of the other big things that happened in the summer of 1985 was Live Aid. Happened on July 13th. It was a benefit to concert for to benefit the Ethiopian famine, and it was organized by Bob Geldof. And there were two concerts, one in London, Wembley Stadium, and the other at John F. Kennedy Stadium in Philadelphia. There were other concerts that were inspired by the initiative that were held around in different countries, such as the Soviet Union, Canada, Japan, Yugoslavia, Australia, Austria, and West Germany. And it was one of the largest scale satellite link-ups in television broadcast of all time, with an estimated audience of 1.9 billion across 150 nations, which at that time equated to 40% of the population. So where were you when Live Aid was being broadcast?
I was only around 6 or 7 years old at that time period. So I have very, very vague memories of watching the Wembley Stadium concert as a small child.
I think that was a summer like we moved. So like if it was on, I probably missed it because we were like moving houses, and that summer like all of our stuff had to be packed up in boxes. So I don't really remember anything about it when I was a kid at all. The Philadelphia host was Jack Nicholson, to tie it back into movies. And Phil Collins also played drums with Led Zeppelin, which was horrible. And you can't really even see Led Zeppelin has tried to block a lot of footage of it because they said it was one of the worst performances. They were kind of out of practice. Jimmy Page's guitar was out of tune. It was just really bad. And then to tie it also back into our world here, in November of night. One other thing about that, you'll love this. 1985 was also the inaugural year for WrestleMania.
That's very true. Yeah.
In Madison Square Garden, where the main event, Hulk Hogan and Mr. T defeated Paul Orndorff and Rowdy Roddy Piper.
That's Orndorff. I don't want to get letters from angry wrestling fans.
We will. Yeah. And I'm sorry. Yeah. Yeah. I should have had you announce that part. You know yeah. that.
I was actually
common knowledge to you.
I was actually going to ask you. I was going to actually ask if you wanted me just to guess what the answer was because I didn't know it.
How many times have we watched it?
Only once. It's pretty terrible.
Is it really?
But it's a big pop culture thing if you're a wrestling fan. So no. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was like one of those big sort of pay-per-view events, I think.
It was actually the first kind of, I mean, it was on a closed circuit TV, but it really began the idea of like pay-per-view and as far as like paying to see wrestling events on TV. Uh-huh. It was definitely one of the first.
Yeah, and then it was released on VHS, later. But if you wanted to watch it, you know, then you had to buy it, or you had, you know, yeah,
yeah. And you know, those wrestling tapes were a big part of the video store culture, which we don't really get to go into. But yeah, that was how a lot of kids saw wrestling events back in the day, was going to the video store and literally renting them on VHS.
Right, and in November 1985, notable comic strip Calvin and Hobbes was debuted, and then also, to wrap things up in a nice little bow, in October of 1985, the very first Blockbuster video rental opened in Dallas, Texas. So, there you go. I can't believe it's been that long. What was that, 45 years ago? October?
It'd be 35 years ago.
35 years ago, October.
Yeah.
I mean, we're also around November. Is today November 5th? Yes, today is November 5th, 1955. I mean, think about that day, 1985, 1955, November 5th. It's a very important day for Back to the Future, right? That was released in 1985.
And just to clarify, guys, as Ryan kind of gave it away there, we are recording this in the past. So at the moment, it's still November 5th, so.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, it's November 5th to us. It may not be.
You're killing the illusion, Ryan. Killing the illusion.
We can't do these live. They know they're recorded previously. Anyway, yeah. I don't think they want that kind of access into their phone. You know what I mean? Anyway. Somebody made a mention on Twitter about it today, being that, you know, today was the day in 1955 that Doc, you know, had the, bumped his head by hanging a clock in his bathroom and fell and had the idea for the flux capacitor, which gave, you know, the ability to time travel. So, you know, when I looked, just to talk about the movies, I looked up, there's a great website, and I'll put it, we'll try to put it in the show notes to Box Office Mojo, and it gives the rankings for, you know, like a lot of statistics, and they can break things down by, you know, what was the, you know, movie of the week in this date in history, or what was the, you know, box office for this month in history. And so they also break it down by seasons, and they define the summer season between May 3rd and August 31st. So the top grossing movie in the United States for the summer of 1985 between May 3rd and August 31st was Rambo First Blood Part 2.
Written by James Cameron.
Yeah. So that is number one. Number two is Back to the Future.
Which is weird because, yeah, I think in a lot of ways Back to the Future has had a lot more pop culture longevity than Rambo. I mean, or at least Rambo Part 2. I mean, in the 80s, Rambo, that version of Rambo was really big and was had a lot of, you know, impact on pop culture, but it's really faded over time. Rambo is almost a relic of really 1980s Reagan America now. I don't think it really holds up as a real enduring pop culture icon, you know, now 35 years later. I mean, they made more Rambo movies after that, but I don't think it has nearly the goodwill and the love that the Back to the Future trilogy has.
Well, here's the other thing. Rambo First Blood Part 2 was released in May 22nd. Back to the Future was released on July 3rd. So you're talking about the middle of the summer. So it only had from July through August to try to like catch up or make the, you know, total gross of what, you know, First Blood Part 2 is out the whole summer, right? Like it got released in the beginning of May. And the other thing too is like, this is a sequel. People already know about Rambo. Then they know what they're going to get when they come into Rambo 2. Back to the Future kind of looked like, you know, this kid's thing, right? Like Michael J. Fox, they knew he was kind of young, but if you really look at the promotion material, it really looks like a kid's movie as compared to like Rambo.
Well, it's a hard movie to expect. Back to the Future, if you think about it, had to be like a nightmare to market.
If you don't know anything about it, right? Go ahead.
I was going to say, can you imagine how hard it would have been to market it to people who have no concept of what it's supposed to be? How do you explain Back to the Future in like a 30-second ad to make people want to see it? I can't imagine how they did that. I'm amazed it was successful. If you think about it, it's such a wacky concept, and it's what's great about it is all the weird little details. But how do you get that across in like a trailer or a 30-second TV spot or a radio ad? To me, it's amazing that Back to the Future caught on like it did.
Well, I think that the idea of time travel, I think, is what captured, you know, people, and obviously you get like wrapped up in the story of Marty and his parents and you know, the nostalgia for you know, the 50s and stuff like that, and how different life was back in the 50s to the 80s, and also how like similar life is for, you know, like kind of for teenagers or, you know, whatever. But you know, so I think you have a double fold there, but I think that you're right, is that how do you market this movie? It's easier, you know, to market, you know, some other movie like a Western. I mean, you have a specific audience or you have a specific genre that you're trying to like market to. Back to the Future, it has such a wide mass appeal. You know, I mean, my parents like Back to the Future just as like little kids, and like how do you really market that as a, like this weird sort of like sci-fi adventure movie? And when you had Back to the Future 2, like they hardly had to do anything but just release the movie and the like droves of people came to see it on opening night, you know?
I think a lot of it really depended on the fact that, that at the time, Michael J. Fox was a very popular TV actor because of Family Ties.
Right.
So they just kind of, in a lot of ways, I think they lucked out. And the movie, of course, is a masterpiece.
Uh-huh.
And once people went to see it, they're like, oh, this is great.
Yeah.
They fell in love with it. But I think really the star power of Michael J. Fox is what initially got them there.
Well, and also to clear things up, by the time 1985 is over, Back to the Future was number one movie of 1985, grossing like $210,000. Rambo only grossed $150,000, but by the end of the summer, it already made like what its total gross was for the year. Like it was already out of theaters by the end of August. You know what I mean? Because it had been out since May. And so by August, there's a lot of new movies coming in. And so with movie houses, even the big movie houses back then had 6 to 8, theater rooms. So, yeah, something had to go. You know what I mean? So I just wanted to make sure that was clear. So the third movie on the list, Cocoon.
Yeah, there's a movie that nobody talks about anymore. We've actually talked about maybe doing Cocoon on the show before, but it's hard to get really excited to revisit Cocoon.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a good movie, but I mean, it's, it's all people swimming, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of cute. Kind of this weird sort of tie-in with science and aliens that give, these people that all of a sudden have new life. The old people that are living like they're young again and feeling like they're young again because they swim in this pool that has these like alien creatures in them,
Yeah, and it starred Steve Guttenberg and Wilford Brimley. Yep. One thing I always found very strange: can you think of a movie star who had kind of a bigger career that now no one gives a crap about more than Steve Guttenberg? Steve Guttenberg was in some very popular movies,
mm-hmm.
And now here in 2020, nobody cares at all what's going on with Steve Guttenberg.
Yeah.
That always struck me as kind of an odd thing, how you go from being such a big star to being really, basically a has-been.
Right. I mean, not only was he in the Police Academy movies, but he was also in Three Men and a Baby, Cocoon. I mean, he was in the movie that we just talked about, which was Home for the Holidays.
Yeah, but before that, he wasn't in a lot of stuff. He definitely had a dry period before that one came out in '95. So I always found that very odd that he had those big hits back in the '80s and then just kind of faded away.
Yeah, he was in The Man Who Wasn't There, who's in Short Circuit, Amazon Women on the Moon.
I mean, Short Circuit was a huge movie,
right? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he did. I mean, but in like, but yeah, because by the '90s, he's doing like Casper direct to video, and a bunch of other things. So I mean, a bunch of movies I've never even heard of: Mojave Phone Booth,
Private
Valentine. Like, what is going on? Like, yeah, like I don't know. Like, to be in movies that were still kind of somewhat successful, like The Man Who Wasn't There or Three Men and a Baby and Short Circuit and Cocoon. I mean, Cocoon was very popular as the third grossing movie of 1985.
The Police Academy movie, the first few Police Academy movies were big movies. They made money. There's a reason there's a gazillion of them,
Yeah, and it was kind of a screwball comedy stuff, but I mean, Bill Murray got away with doing screwball comedy stuff and having an excellent movie career.
Yeah, he was in Meatballs, for God's sakes.
Yeah, and like movies like Stripes and all that other stuff. So it's interesting. But then after that, number four is a movie that we haven't reviewed, but we've talked about several times, is The Goonies.
Yeah, and if I had my way, we're never going to cover The Goonies.
Yeah.
I like The Goonies, but I don't love it as much as other people do. It's definitely overrated. It's good. I mean, but everyone, I mean, it's such a pop culture thing. What more can you really say about the Goonies?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, it's a kid's adventure. To me, looking back on it, it's really kind of corny. Like, Sean Astin just talking to One-Eyed Willie like he's actually there, yeah, you know, all the time and stuff. And it's really kind of cartoony. It's fun. And I definitely see the tie-ins to, you know, and the influence to shows like Stranger Things. But yeah, I mean, it's just one of those family movies that is like a good, you know, teen or good, not teen, but good, you know.
It's a movie for preteens. Let's be honest.
It's a preteen movie, yeah.
It's a movie that's good. Its legacy has entirely been built out of goodwill. Out of nostalgia, excuse me. Its entire legacy is based completely out of nostalgia that guys our age have for it because they saw it when they were like 8 or 10.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, that felt like a real, you know, important movie. It was made for them, and no movie that had that kind of production quality, you know, was made for them.
But I'll go ahead and put a pin on it. The Goonies, it's good, but super overrated.
I agree. A movie that we've talked about, number 5, Fletch.
Well, I think we said all we really can about Fletch. You know, if you want to hear our thoughts on Fletch, go back and listen to the episode in our archives. It's episode number 10.
Yeah, and because that was, I think it was also, we talked about Fletch was filmed during the summer of 1984, I think during the Olympics in LA, but it was released in 85, fifth grossing movie during the summer. So nice. And, you know, I just wish we had more of that kind of Chevy Chase. Moving on, number 6, Bond film, the last one for Roger Moore, A View to a Kill.
A really great theme song.
Yeah, Duran Duran wrote and played the theme song. Grace Jones, Dolph Lundgren.
Yeah, first film appearance by Dolph Lundgren, yeah.
That's correct. And I mean, but Roger Moore just like totally got, you know, blasted for being like looking old and wrinkly and being 007, you know what I mean?
He looks rough in it. Yeah, he did. Yeah, but he honestly does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he looks like granddad out there trying to like fight Dolph Lundgren.
Yeah, it's a bit ridiculous, you know.
Yeah. Number 7 is another Chevy Chase classic, National Lampoon's European Vacation. So the follow-up to just Vacation, this is the European Vacation. And, I mean, really funny cult classic movie, I think. I mean, any of the National Lampoons, like any of the Vacation movies are just total classics to me.
I think European Vacation is very underrated. Most people skip over it because it's not as good as the first one, and it's not as like beloved as Christmas Vacation. Mm-hmm. But European Vacation to me is pretty funny.
It is.
It's got a lot of great gags. But I guess in a lot of ways, it's also way more adult than the other two, and I think that's what's kept it from having like this nostalgic like sheen that, you know, Vacation has and Christmas Vacation have, because they're not really movies you watch with Europeans. Not really a movie you want to watch with like your mom and dad.
Yep, that's true. Yeah, and it is rated PG-13 for some brief nudity. Let's just be honest. Be prepared when they go to Germany, or Austria, or wherever that they're at. But it's still a. To me, I think it's absolutely hilarious. And I think if you were to ask a lot of people, you know, to me, the Steve Carell from The Office, like, borrowed a lot from Chevy Chase's character from the Vacation movies, for sure. Playing that aloof, kind of, you know, kind of daft, but really confident, you know, kind of character. You know?
Yeah, Chevy really created that whole kind of comedic thing of, like I said, of just a very confident idiot.
Yes. Number eight, movie that I have not heard of. So you have to help me out here, Esther, because you're the movie guy. Pale Rider.
The Clint Eastwood movie? I've actually never seen it. I believe that's a Clint Eastwood film. I'm going to admit I've never seen it. I think it's a Clint Eastwood film. I can't know everything.
Right?
Let's see here.
Yes, 1985 American Western film produced and directed by Clint Eastwood. So the title is in reference to the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. The rider of the pale horse is Death. So highest grossing Western of the 1980s.
I'm going to go ahead and get something that might get my geek card pulled. I'm not the biggest fan of Clint Eastwood's writing and directing. I really like his spaghetti westerns with Leone, and I like some of his films, but I've never been really motivated to watch all of his directorial work. I mean, I get why he's beloved by a lot of people as a director. Just not really my thing. They always felt more like the kind of movies my dad would want to watch.
To me, I think that they're slow and deliberate, but I don't know. To me, I just think that they're made slow, and then maybe you think that there's something more important going on or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I will say the besides Unforgiven, which is a really great film, I really like A Perfect World with Kevin Costner. Mm-hmm. That's a Clint Eastwood directed film. I think is really good.
Mm-hmm. And the Unforgiven, but that I think is attributed to a lot to the script. But moving on, number nine, a movie we also talked about last season in season two, Brewster's Millions, starring Richard Pryor and John Candy.
I thought that one held up very well. If you guys want to hear that one, I'm not sure of the episode number, but it was very recent in near the end of season two, as we covered a Richard Pryor double feature. We watched that, and we both loved it, so go back and check that one out. We paired it with The Unfortunate, The Toy, which we're not going to talk anymore about, but yeah.
Yeah, because that was an episode about Richard Pryor, and if I look back, I can tell you that was, I don't know if they're listed, but it should be episode number 37.
Yeah, we've done quite a lot, man.
Yeah, man. It's a while back. It just seems not too long ago that we watched that movie, but I still love that movie, and I think it's great, and I think it's worth a watch. So,
oh yeah, definitely Brewster's Millions. Directed by the great Walter Hill. John Candy's phenomenal in it.
Mm-hmm.
Such a fun movie.
And then real quickly to wrap up, number 10, E.T. the Extraterrestrial was the 1985 re-release. So
never heard of it.
It wasn't really a movie. I think it's funny though that just it shows up here in the top grossing movies of 1985, because like I said, a lot of movie theaters, you know, we didn't have like 12 or 16 or 20 theaters. So, you know, a lot of times they would want like kind of a sure thing. So they would, you know, E.T. and people could bring their kids to see it because, like we said, the first blockbuster wasn't until October of 1985, and then it took a while for them to like be in almost every city. But yeah, that was one way that, you know, you could go back and rewatch it or experience it in the theater. I wish we could continue to do that and have the theater experience. But
well, when theaters open back up soon, probably in this year, 2021. They're probably gonna have a lot more of that. They did some of the revival screenings in 2020, but mm-hmm. I think as things get safer out there in the world during 2021, we're probably gonna have a lot more of those. Hey, let's go watch Raiders of the Lost Ark. Right. You know, because they're not gonna have any new movies to show.
Yeah.
They're gonna hit a point where they're gonna run out of all the backlog movies. They're gonna show all the things they've been saving, mm-hmm. and there's gonna be like a good, you know, probably 9 month period where there's not a lot of big films to release because they've been sitting because they just didn't do any filming for most of 2020.
Yeah,
so and we're it's like a spot why, where there's no movies,
right? And why not have a big blockbuster that's going to draw a crowd, like a one time only, like a one night only or one weekend only kind of, you know, reopening. I mean, AMC already tried to do that with like Back to the Future and all that, but yeah, and also to go back to my point. Instead of going to the theater, you know, a lot of push in the 2000s was to bring the theater experience in your home with, you know, HD and DVD and surround sound and all that kind of fun stuff. So so now we get to enjoy streaming and hopefully your physical media because, you know, we can never guarantee that it's going to be streaming.
We are very pro-physical media on this show. You know, if you love a movie, buy a copy of it that you can hold in your hand.
Yep. So number 11, you'll like this one. This is also kind of a cult, you know, favorite for our audience. Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome.
I could talk about Mad Max all day long. And
I know you love it, right?
It's one of my very favorite franchises. And Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome is definitely the weakest one of the series. It's only partially directed by George Miller. He lost his producing partner during the filming of it. And he was definitely going through a period of mourning during the making of the film. And you can kind of see where he kind of checks out a little bit. But still, there's so much good stuff in Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. You have the Thunderdome itself, which is such a cool idea. You have Tina Turner, and she's great in the film.
Mm-hmm.
You have that terrible subplot with the kids, but still, there's enough good stuff in it that it really carries you through the film. The production design is great, mm-hmm. and who doesn't love that theme song? I mean,
mm-hmm.
that you know, to me, I think they're such fun movies, and like I said, even though it's the weakest one, it's still a great movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love all the Mad Max films. Just totally fun to watch. And yeah, like you said, even Thunderdome. Moving on to number 12, Saint Elmo's Fire. And this
I've never seen it, but you've seen it, right?
Come on, Matt.
I haven't.
Son of a bitch. You gotta see it. You've never hey, now. Seen it? Sorry.
Not all the way through. I've seen you know, because I was a kid with HBO, so I've seen parts of it.
Okay, well,
I've never seen the whole thing.
Okay, well, I mean, it stars the majority of the Brat Pack, which consists of, you know, most of the cast members from The Breakfast Club, including Emilio Estevez, Rob Lowe, Judd Nelson, but. I mean, in the Brat Pack is all those people I just mentioned, but also Anthony Michael Hall, Andrew McCarthy, Demi Moore, Molly Ringwald, and Ally Sheedy. So starring in St. Elmo's Fire, most of these people, even though it was not a John Hughes film, it still starred Emilio Estevez, Rob Lowe, Andrew McCarthy, Demi Moore, Judd Nelson, Ally Sheedy. It did star Mary Winningham and Andy McDowell. Which are kind of like honorary members of the Brat Pack. And I think it's a great movie. It's another one of those movies about the difficulty of being, you know, kind of like in Breaking Away and also Fandango, where you're becoming a kid and then really becoming an adult. You know, you think of yourself as an adult, like, I'm, you know, 18 years old. I can vote. I can make my own decisions. But to really be in that adult, like, I have to pay bills. I have a job. I have, you know, I've got to do these things. That sort of stuff. Like, and it's all about, you know, love and all that kind of fun stuff. But I think it's a great movie.
Well, and maybe we'll get to it eventually on the show, so I can knock that off my list of shame.
You need to. Rob Lowe's great in that.
Yeah, there's only so many hours in the day, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Too busy watching Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome for the 800th time.
Yeah. And it's also one of my favorite Andy McCarthy roles, too. So, all right. Number 13 is a movie we briefly mentioned one time. And talking about Kevin Costner. But this weird Western called Silverado that starred John Cleese, Jeff Goldblum, and Kevin Costner.
Yeah, I mean it's a good film. I've not seen it in years, but I have very fond memories of it being good. My dad watched it a lot when I was growing up, but But to be honest with you, I've not seen it since I was probably 9 or 10.
Mm-hmm.
We should probably watch it for the show.
Yeah, we should, probably should. It's, you know, it is, it's not too long. It's 133 minutes. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely interesting for John Cleese and Jeff Goldblum. I mean, you had me at that in Western, so we'll put that on our list.
And I've been wanting to do another spaghetti Western, so we should pair that with another spaghetti Western.
Yeah, sounds like a good idea. Maybe one of the good Clint Eastwood spaghetti Westerns. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
All right. So moving on, 14, we'll just kind of briefly mention, I've not heard of this movie either, Prizzy's Honor.
That I've got no idea what that is, man. I'm not going to lie to you. But I want to look at it. I want to look it up, though. So let's,
all right, Prizzy's let's try Honor. To find... Put it on the list. Pee-wee's Big Adventure at number 15. I mean, we talked about Tim Burton and talked about how great it was. I remember watching this movie a lot on HBO. It's so much fun. You think Pee-wee's like, you know, kind of a kid and it's kind of like awkward, but, you know, it led for him to do Pee-wee's Playhouse. And then, you know, and then later on he did Big Top Pee-wee. So, but that, it, you know, that whole adventure of him finding his, you know, stolen bicycle is just really sort of iconic film, you know, for this time, for 1985.
Well, and it's definitely something that stuck with me as of growing up, because I'll never be able to forget the idea that the Alamo doesn't have a basement.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The basement of the Alamo. Then in number 16, another movie that we talked about, Beverly Hills Cop. So yep, did really, really well in 1985.
I think that was episode 20 we talked about Beverly Hills Cop.
Yeah, because it was released, when that released in 1984, but I mean, it just kind of get re-released in 1985, right? I don't think it got, let me look it up. Beverly Hills Cop, if I look up when it was released, was, 1984. But I mean, once again, gets re-released in theaters next year because it's a fun movie to watch. You know, it was like all your friends are out and you're like, hey, well, we'll go see it all together. Like, okay, you know. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm gonna stop you for a second. Prizzy's Honor stars Jack Nicholson and Kathleen Turner and Robert Loggia.
Okay.
It's about two assassins who fall in love.
Interesting.
Directed by John Huston. Nice. I imagine it's probably not that great, because if I've never heard of it, you've never heard of it, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a lost classic. Who knows?
All right. Well, since we're up to like 15, 16, I'm just going to kind of skip around because I cannot get through. There's like, of this list, there's like 72 movies on this list. So I'm just going to kind of skip around and kind of hit the highlights from here on out. Okay. So another great movie that came out is Weird Science.
Yeah.
And that's another iconic film from the 80s.
That's a formative movie for any young man who grew up during a certain time, for sure.
Yeah, John Hughes. And even one of my favorite parts in that movie is when the guy shows up with the motorcycle or whatever. You can definitely tell that's like some Mad Max stuff going on. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's definitely an homage to Mad Max. But you've also got that great Bill Paxton performance. You've got a very young Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah.
Classic, man.
Yeah, Anthony Michael Hall. I mean, it's another kind of Brat Pack kind of movie. But yeah, I mean, definitely kind of fun being a screwball comedy, but, you know, being a little more, slightly more tasteful, I guess, than something like Porky's, I guess you would say.
Only slightly, let's be honest.
Only slightly. All right, so another movie, Fright Night.
We're going to do Fright Night. I love Fright Night.
This is a movie that comes up a lot, I see, in like the cult sort of classic circles, and I think it falls, even though I think it's rated R, I think it still falls in line with one of those like really fun sort of horror movies.
Yeah, it's definitely a fun horror film. It's not campy, but it's definitely got I'm trying to think of a good way to explain it. It's like a romp. It's got a fun quality to it. It's never too scary. Mm-hmm. It's almost more of an adventure story, but mixed in with horror.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's not meant to scare you. It's meant to give you like a bit of a spook or a jump But you're not going to be, like, terrified the entire time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'll look forward to that. I've never seen it.
It's got the guy who played Prince Humperdinck from The Princess Bride, Chris Sarandon, as the vampire in it. It's really fun.
Mm-hmm. So another movie that came in number 20 is this other really terrible Disney movie called The Black Cauldron.
Now, I've not seen The Black Cauldron in years. I remember even as a kid thinking it was boring.
Uh-huh.
So I've not seen it since I was a little kid, but I remember thinking it was very dull when I was little.
It's an animated, like, fantasy film. It's set in the mythical land of Prydain? I don't know. In the early Middle Ages? Anyway, it did so poorly. It took like 13 years for Disney to release it on VHS. So it is the first Disney animated film to receive a PG rating. So yeah, it's out on VHS and DVD. If you're interested in it, because it is a fantasy film. But like you said,
it's not one Disney's proud of because they don't really market it. They don't make like toys of it. They don't make big announcements of it being released on like Blu-ray. You won't find like a Black Cauldron ride at Walt Disney World, I don't believe.
Well, because I would think that they probably wanted to do some fantasy film or cash in on, you know, stuff like The Dark Crystal or something like that. But probably other executives got involved and goes, well, this is Disney. We can't do that. You know, and so it just kind of gets watered down, probably.
Well, people forget Disney really went into a slump in the 80s. They did. They didn't really end until The Little Mermaid came out in the 90s.
Yep.
Disney was not in a good place in 1985.
No. Moving on quickly. Number 21, John Candy favorite, Summer Rental.
Yeah, that's one I'm really looking forward to revisiting on the show eventually.
Really?
Eventually, yeah.
Yeah, like you haven't seen it like lately in a while.
I've not seen it. That's one I've not seen since I was a kid, and I would love to go back and watch it again. Yeah.
Oh my gosh! Like I bought it or something like that, and me and my wife like watch it like every summer. Like she likes to watch movies. Like she's one of these like Hallmark like Christmas movie fanatics, but
yeah.
She likes to watch movies that are around the season, and that's one of the movies that she likes. It's like around summertime. And, you know, watch summer vacation movies. And I probably watch it every year.
Well, I think we should pair that one with The Great Outdoors.
Yeah.
I think that'd be a very fun one for the summertime.
Yeah, that's another summer, like, good summer family vacation movie that's also, like, really funny. But, yeah, that movie in particular stars Rip Torn as well. So,
From there, we go back and listen to our Dodgeball episode where we heap praise on how great Rip Torn is.
And he plays almost the same character where he's like this, you know, swashbuckling, you know, guy trying to coach, you know, the underdog into, winning the regalia or whatever. So,
yeah,
it's great.
Like Rip Torn is basically plays Rip Torn, but he's great at being Rip Torn.
He is. Yeah. There's no other. Moving on is 23. So another, Michael J. Fox was kind of like Phil Collins back in 85, right? Like he was everywhere. Like if he's everywhere, like Phil Collins was everywhere. So Teen Wolf.
Yeah. Now there's a classic 80s film of like pop culture nostalgia, but that one holds up pretty well. It's such a weird, goofy movie. Mm-hmm. But it works. It works. Like it should be like the dumbest thing in the world. I mean, you've got a basketball playing werewolf. You got Michael J. Fox in this ridiculous werewolf costume. He's surfing on a van.
Yeah.
He's making out with girls while being this werewolf.
Yeah.
And it should be the dumbest thing you've ever seen. But it works and it's fun and it just moves along at a good rapid pace. And when it's over with, you're like, that's a really solid film.
Right. And his best friend plays like the girl that that's his friend, but she's the girl that he should be with. Like her name is Boof. Like it's just,
Boof.
Just,
yeah.
It's just like really just like really odd and weird, but I think it captures how awkward that it really is to be like a teenager, really. You know,
I was so in love with Booth when I was a little kid. Like even before I really understood like relationships and like hormones, I had like the biggest like little kid crush on Booth.
Yeah, Booth, the girl that played her, Susan Ursitti, is Lisa Booth Marconi. Anyway, she had like the short brown hair. She kind of reminded me of like Winona Ryder, you know what I mean? Like a little bit older character than what she played in Lucas, you know what I mean?
Oh yeah, she was in Zapped. That's the movie I had seen with her. Zapped is terrible.
Oh really?
She was in the
Zapped, Teen Wolf, Funland, doing Planet Earth. She did The Walking Dead in 1985.
Not the same thing, but yeah. Yeah. Teen Wolf is a really fun. It's so dopey, uh-huh. And it should be terrible, but it's really fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really is. I completely agree. So moving on, another weird movie that they played on like Comedy Central and the comedy like shows. One of the early movies that they I remember seeing on that channel is this weird movie called The Gods Must Be Crazy.
Oh yeah, The Gods Must Be Crazy. Yeah
really weird. Yeah. Sort of. It was more like British comedy, British humor, where you know, this guys in, you know, they're in like Africa teaching some like you know, school like out in the bush or whatever, and mm-hmm. it's just really kind of awkward, kind of love comedy, but still kind of.
You want to know a really weird fact about that movie?
What's that?
It was huge in Hong Kong. Uh-huh. And Hong Kong made like two unofficial sequels to it.
Really?
Hmm? Mm. Yeah, it was a weird bit of trivia there for you.
That is weird. Moving on, in number 26, starring Eric Stoltz, who wasn't in Back to the Future, right? Is the movie that he was starring in, a movie called Mask. And I read, I recently read an article about why he wasn't in Back to the Future, and it was because he really played the role a little bit too serious. Like, he insisted on everybody on the set call him Marty, and everybody just kind of like went along with it. But yeah, the comedy fun part just wasn't really coming out. But really, I think that serious acting and that serious like what they call it, method acting, I think really comes out in Mask.
Yeah, Mask was actually a pretty big deal to me when I was a kid, because, you know, I've got a disability, so seeing a movie about another kid with a disability trying to live his life and have a normal life really resonated with me when I was young, and it's a movie that I watched, you know, several times when I was a kid, and it's got a great Cher performance, it's got, you know, the immortal Sam Elliott in it, too.
Yeah,
and
Sam Elliott.
It's such a touching film, and it ends with that great Bob Seger song over the end credits. It's a really formative film for me.
Yeah, I remember seeing Mass. I really liked it a lot, because it, once again, even though that the he, you know, has this you know, kind of face dysplasia, like to see him go through the same sort of awkward, you know, sort of teen things, you know, and then also dealing with his you know, mom. And her mom's boyfriend, you know, who's like a, you know, in a motorcycle gang and all that kind of stuff.
And it also kind of portrayed those kind of characters in a very positive way. Like, they could have been just shown as like white trash or like really low people, but it showed them as just being everyday people, which is a pretty novel idea in the 80s, to show basically lower income people. It's just what they were, which is normal, caring parents to a child.
Right. And I'm trying to find that Bob Seger song for you.
I believe it was Roll Me Away. I think that's the title of it.
Yes. Rock and Roll. Oh, yeah. Roll Me Away. That's correct. Roll Me Away. The next sort of thing, number 28, Year of the Dragon.
Which I've always wanted to see. I've heard it's good. I've never seen
it. Never seen it? Okay.
It's on my list of shame.
So. All right. Police Academy 2, number 30. Their first Police assignment.
Police Academy 2 is my favorite Police Academy film.
Yeah.
I'll say that much.
Yeah, I think it's one of the best. They actually had a little more of a budget that time. It still didn't. It missed Steve Guttenberg, but it had just about everybody else. And,
well, it's the one where Bobcat also really takes a leading role in it.
Yeah,
and I've always liked Bobcat Goldthwait. You know, he's a great filmmaker and a great writer. But I mean, that character always made me laugh, especially as a kid. I mean, mm-hmm. I've not seen it in probably 20 years.
Yeah,
but I've always had very fond memories of Police Academy 2.
Go ahead.
Again, we're never going to talk about those movies on the show officially.
Was that the one is Police Academy 2 the Citizens on Patrol? Was that the one?
That's three, I think. Three, I had I to think? Go back. There's so many of
oh,
them.
Oh, right. I think I really like three. But yeah, both of them are really funny, I think. Police Academy movies, yeah.
Yeah, in the first one, Bobcat plays the villain, or one of the villains.
Yep.
And in the second, he somehow ends up joining the Police Academy himself.
Right.
It's ridiculous, but as a kid, I found it funny, and I still like it a lot.
Yeah, it's almost like those... Like the airplane movies, you know, whatever. It's almost like so far-fetched. It's just so funny.
Yeah, super on PC, super silly.
Yeah.
But I like silly. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah. And then 31, Desperately Seeking Susan.
Now, that's one I watched a lot as a kid, but all I can remember is like Eugene Levy flirting with Madonna.
Yeah.
That's literally the only thing I remember about it.
Right.
And like I remember like one bit of dialogue from it where he talks about how he knows she's lying, and she goes, how do you know I'm lying? He goes, because your lips are moving. And that's the first time I had ever heard that line, and that it stuck with me since I was a little kid till now. That's literally the only thing I remember about that.
Uh-huh.
And of course the theme song. I remember the theme song.
Yeah, from Madonna. But yeah, also starring Rosanna Arquette, and it's kind of a fun movie. I mean, it really I think really shows a little bit more grittier sort of New York City than what you kind of see in other, you know, New York City movies around that time. To me, I thought it was fascinating just for that reason.
Yeah, I'd be willing to rewatch it. If anything, just to see Eugene Levy in a role that he never really got to do again. He never really got to be the leading man of anything again.
Right. So moving on. Another cult classic, The Return of the Living Dead.
That's probably one of the one of the classic horror comedies.
Yeah,
it's to me that's almost more of an influential zombie film than Dawn of the Dead or Night of the Living Dead.
Yeah,
because you know everyone makes the joke about zombies eating brains.
Uh huh.
You know, but that's not in the Romero films at all.
Mm-hmm.
Never in Dawn of the Dead or Night of the Living Dead or Day of the Dead or any of those does the zombie ever go brains, but in Return of the Living Dead that happens.
Okay.
So that's where that comes from, and it is it's a funny movie, and it's got great gore effects. It's a really good horror comedy. If you've never seen it, Ryan, we may need to mark that down for maybe Halloween of this year for this season.
Uh-huh.
It's a really fun film.
Oh wow! Oh yeah, yeah. That would be great. This was a movie that was released in December of 1985, but it still has, you know, made some money. Number 33 on the list, a movie that we talked about, starring Harrison Ford, Witness.
Really good film.
Yeah, really good film. I don't know what episode that was, but that was our Harrison Ford episode. And next time I should have all of these like lined up. But you can find it on our website at video-culture.com. Another movie that we talked about again, number 36, Gotcha.
I never thought we'd mention Gotcha again. But yeah, Gotcha's a movie we watched very early on in the show. And, you know, I was surprised by how good I thought it was. I mean, it's not amazing,
uh-huh.
but it's certainly worth watching.
Yeah, it was released in May of 1985. So, I mean, this was in the summer. So, yeah, I mean, it wasn't really that much of a hit. It was 37. You know, it didn't make a whole lot. But still, I thought it was entertainment. I really liked that movie. I thought it was great. Another movie that you and I both love, I know, because we've talked about it before, Real Genius.
Real Genius, it's almost too big for us to talk about on the show.
It's almost too big, but almost I think that we can still explore. I mean, it's just it's so fun.
I love it. Yeah.
It's so fun. Yeah. And I think it's one of those movies that gets overlooked sometimes and talking about movies about kids and, you know, because it's dealing with college age kids, you know what I mean? But it's still the main character that you follow, like who you sort of view everything through. He's really kind of a younger kind of kid, right? He's almost like high school age.
Yeah, and everyone kind of, no one really remembers him when they think back on Real Genius. They only really think about Val Kilmer's character, which is an interesting thing because Val Kilmer's character is such a force of personality in that film. He's like Ferris Bueller if Ferris Bueller wasn't a jerk.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. True.
Yeah. But yeah, I love Real Genius. It's got so many great bits in it. We might end up doing it on the show.
Yeah, so many great one-liners. And then in number 38, another movie that I watched constantly as a kid, Explorers.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, it's one of those weird movies that who was it directed by?
I think it was Joe Dante.
Joe Dante, that's what I was about to say, but I didn't want to be wrong. But, you know, it starts off, I think it has one of the most interesting, you know, intros. Right, like, and then, but the second half just gets so weird and cartoony when the alien actually shows up, and it gets real, just kind of zany after that, and it's just kind of really kind of odd. Doesn't really go where you think it's gonna go. It's still kind of a fun sort of kids movie, but definitely like from the midpoint on, like when they're actually like in the spaceship, it's definitely like a kids movie after that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but it's got great effects work. I mean, It's very fun. It moves very well. Mm-hmm. It's enjoyable. I mean, I've only seen it a few times. I didn't watch it when I was younger. I actually saw it when I was a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
But I've always thought it was a surprisingly good movie.
Mm-hmm. Another movie, number 39, that came out in 1985, The Man with One Red Shoe, starring Tom Hanks.
Yeah, now that's one again I've not seen in years. We should rewatch. We're gonna do more Tom Hanks on the show, but all of his movies that no one really remembers, and that's one that definitely is on the list that we need to do.
Yeah, I thought it was enjoyable. It's really kind of where he gets kind of involved in some espionage, some spy, you know, kind of gumshoe kind of stuff going on where he gets mistaken for. So it's really kind of funny because he gets mistaken as this, you know, secret agent because he is wearing like one red shoe, but it was really just a ruse, right? Like he was never meant to be like that. And he plays this like classical, like cellist or something like that in Washington, D.C. So anyway, go ahead.
I think you played the cello. Yeah. Like I said, I've not seen it since I was a kid. Yeah. But it was one of the things I watched on HBO quite a bit growing up.
He's just great at playing the everyman. You know what I mean? So
yeah, we I think we need to do that. And like I said, we need to watch it in depth on the show and pair it with something like Joe versus the Volcano or something
or,
like that.
The Money Pit.
Or the Money Pit. Yeah, really get all those early Tom Hanks roles out of the way because I think we're about halfway through them now at this point. So we might as well. Go for the hat trick.
And the money pit, it's got some great scenes. I think it's actually also kind of underrated, you know, Tom Hanks' performance, really. Moving on, another movie I watched a lot as a kid, Daryl. D-A-R-Y-L.
I've never seen Daryl.
You've never seen Daryl?
Nope. I mean, I know of it, but I don't really know anything about it, you know?
Oh, man. It is a great movie because this kid, he's like a cyborg kind of kid, right? And it really has, you know, once again, I'm going to, you know, Stranger Things, they've borrowed a lot like from Daryl. You can definitely tell that. And it's a fun, I mean, it's kind of more kid and family driven. And it really has a fantastic, like, payoff ending.
Well, I should watch it. I mean, I've got access to it, so I should get around to watching it.
All right, and moving on, 42, I'll just mention this quickly. This is another, like body switch movies, but we didn't cover it in our first episode because it's a movie called Just One of the Guys. And
that's a weird premise. Yeah, just one of the guys.
Yeah, where this girl, she thinks that, you know, her teacher's not giving her, you know, credit for this newspaper story because she works for the, you know, she's like writing for the school newspaper. So she's like, oh, yeah, but it's probably because I'm a girl. I'm not a guy. So she goes to the neighboring school and then is... you know, goes to the neighboring school and it is a guy, dresses up as a guy, and then another guy winds up falling in love, you know, or dressed up as a girl. Is that what it was?
No, she dresses up as a guy and she goes to this other school.
Oh,
and,
no, she falls in love with a guy.
Yeah, she falls in love with a guy and the guy doesn't realize she's a girl, so the comic hijinks ensue. Yeah. Yeah, for some reason I saw this a lot on HBO when I was a kid. I've probably seen it 3 or 4 times, so I don't know why. It's pretty good. I mean, it's definitely not anything to go to seek out, but I mean, if you run across it, you're not going to hate yourself for watching it.
Right. Well, just a few more movies to get through. Amadeus.
Classic.
Yeah. The Legend of Billie Jean.
That's another one people tell me I need to see, and I just have never seen it.
That was the first movie starring that's the first Christian Slater movie. Hold on, one.
I had no idea he was in that.
Yeah, he was like only like 15 at the time, so
just doing his little Jack Nicholson impression. Yeah.
Yeah, man. I don't know if he was at 15. I've not seen that movie either, but we'll just move on from the list right here, and then. Let's see. Girls Just Want to Have Fun. And also rounding up the list at number 71, not number 72, mind you, it's the last one, but number 71, Better Off Dead.
Which, again, is a movie that we both love a lot.
Yeah. But if you look at what it made, you know, $76,000.
Yeah. It was not popular. No. But yeah.
Well, it's because... Didn't they, Warner Brothers, like, limited the release, you know, to so many theaters? And
well, you want to talk about a movie that's hard to market. How do you market a movie that's that absurd, but isn't visually absurd? Like, it looks very normal, but it's super weird once you start paying attention to it.
Yeah.
That's got to be really hard to market and make people understand what you're going for. But if you guys want to hear more about that, go into our archives on the website. Again, that's video-culture.com. It's our John Cusack episode.
Yep.
Where we talked in depth about it. Ryan and I are both big fans. It's a really fun movie.
Yeah, we talked about that in another movie that he was in called Pushing 10. But yeah, we talk about Better Off Dead and what an impact that has made on movies. And it's just so strange. Such a good movie. And there were other re-release movies that were all on the list. Like Ghostbusters, you know, really that was released like a year before. Gremlins, you know, that got released and that was also released in 84. That, you know, enjoyed some more, you know, time, you know, in theaters in 1985. And then also like movies like the Care Bears movie, you know, that also came out and got to show in 1985. But just to kind of, you know, talk about it, like there are other movies in 1985 that we know came out in 85, but they weren't during the summer of 1985. And some of those movies I'll just mention real briefly. Rocky IV, The Color Purple, Out of Africa, The Jewel of the Nile. So, I mean, oh, and another one of the movies that we also like, Spies Like Us. I mean, Spies Like Us didn't come out until December. Rocky IV came out in November. Color Purple and Out of Africa, I mean, they were definitely going for, like, Oscar nods, so they came out in December. So did The Jewel of the Nile. So it's like, you know, go figure.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of stuff came out during that period. that you know, was either successful at the time or had a lot of cultural impact. Or in a movie like Jewel of the Nile is a movie that I think is pretty great that no one really talks about anymore.
No, and talk about a movie that had, you know, kind of a big budget. It was a very sort of adventure film. It was really sort of a I don't want to say like an Indiana Jones copy, but it definitely has that vibe.
It kind of is an Indiana Jones copy film.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of Indiana Jones for your mom. That's the best way to explain Jewel of the Nile.
Yeah, my mom loved both of those movies. Both the Jewel of the Nile and
Romancing the Stone,
yes.
Yeah, I think they're both good. I mean, obviously, Romancing the Stone's way better.
Right.
But I think Jewel of the Nile's pretty good, too.
Yeah. Yeah, I like them both. And Jewel of the Nile has Danny DeVito in it. I mean,
That's true. And we all know how, you know, cherished Danny DeVito is now in 2021 and in this year of our Lord, because you know, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. He's basically a comedy saint.
Oh yeah.
Now at this point.
Oh, definitely. And so many great roles that he played throughout the years, and you know, and what a great penguin he played. I mean, just so grotesque.
To hear about that, go back and listen to our episode 50, which was only a few episodes before this one, where we discussed all about Batman and Batman Returns.
Yeah, I mean, I actually just, well, I'll tell you about that later. Somebody made a reference about the penguin in the nose biting scene, but I'll mention that for later, for after the show. Just to talk about music, what was happening in 1985. Don't you forget about me, Simple Minds. Power of Love by Huey Lewis in the News, obviously, because of the movie. So these are all like tie-in movies, right? A View to a Kill, Duran Duran. St. Elmo's Fire. You know, there's a song too, St. Elmo's Fire.
Oh, yeah, I actually know that.
By John Parr.
I actually know the song way more than I know than I know the film.
Right. And We Don't Need Another Hero by Tina Turner, which was from Mad Max and Beyond the Thunderdome.
And I'll go ahead and say it's the best one out of all the songs you just mentioned. That song is a banger, man.
Oh, it is. And also to mention, I failed to mention The Breakfast Club, too, as far as a movie that came out in 1985. That was another John Hughes film, as long as Weird Science. But that came out in February of 1985. So not on the list from the domestic box office, you know, for summer of 1985. So.
Yeah, but a huge, huge film.
Yeah, I mean, the budget was $1 million. The box office made $51.5 million. Certainly, you know, a popular film of its time, and you know, still, you know, a cult favorite, pop culture favorite.
I mean, hugely influential to pop culture. I mean, it gets referenced all the time.
Yes,
in pop culture.
But Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert were so peeved at 1985's movies that they actually assembled an entire show about the worst of the worst. Siskel called it one of the dullest, most juvenile, most homogenized summer movie seasons in recent memory. And among their targets was movies that we didn't talk about. The Bride with Sting and Jennifer Beals as the Bride of Frankenstein.
And Clancy Brown, who we brought up a bunch on this show. Yeah.
They did mention the Man with One Red Shoe starring Tom Hanks. They apparently blasted that one. And then also another movie I failed to mention, Return to Oz.
Return to Oz does suck.
Yeah, which Ebert declared so depressing, it was some kind of torture for me to sit through it.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
Is it?
It's dull and it is depressing.
Right. And despite being released in 1986, Ferris Bueller's actual quote-unquote day off was June 5th, 1985, and that was pointed out from the data from the Braves versus Cubs games that he attended. So, and one other movie, one last film that I'll mention that was released in December of 1985 was that we didn't mention from the summer is a movie that we both love, Clue.
Yeah, Clue is really fun. We're going to need to do Clue at some point.
We have to. It's just such an all-star cast. You know, Martin Mull.
Tim Curry.
Michael McKean. Just Absolutely fantastic movie.
It's such a fun, like, madcap whodunit. I just want to find a movie that would pair perfectly with that energy, and I'm still trying to think about what would go really well with it.
Madeline Kahn, you know.
The great Madeline Kahn. Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, we have to, I know that's going to be on our list, and yeah, because what other movie is like Clue? Like, that is such an, you know, kind of enigma kind of movie, you know what I mean?
Yeah, there are movies that try to capture the same tone, but they're just not as good, you know? So it's,
And it's based on a board game of all things.
Yeah. So, I mean, so I've constantly been trying to think of a movie that I think that's enjoyable, but would pair really well with Clue, and I'm still trying to mull it over to try to find the right double feature to do with
Maybe
it.
Maybe we just ought to do a watch-along. I don't know.
That's not a bad idea. So we'll scribble it down as a tentative, and but I think we're going to get to it pretty soon.
Yeah. So, but any more that you want to say about Wrapped Up? I mean, I know the biggest movie of the year was you know, from the summer of '85. Technically, to Box Office Mojo, was Rambo: First Blood Part Two, but we all know it was what captured the hearts of all of us is, you know, Back to the Future, right?
It's true. And so much of that year for me, and when I was that age, was made up again of watching stuff from the year before on HBO. But these movies that came out in 85, especially the summer of 85, so many of them were such a big part of my childhood growing up, you know. They really informed a lot of who I am as a film fan. Especially things like Fright Night and, again, Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome.
Yep.
So it was, without some of these movies, I'd be a very different kind of film watcher, if I'd even be a film fan at all. So.
Well, I mean, there were a lot of sort of, if you think about kids' movies, not like Care Bears or like, you know, like movies like cartoon movies or whatever, there was a lot in there with a lot of substance that weren't just like, you know, Bad News Bears type sports movies or like whatever. I mean, these were like real stories with kids. I mean, just look at the list. Back to the Future, Goonies, Weird Science, Better Off Dead, Real Genius, Teen Wolf, a little bit of European Vacation because they follow the you know, the kid around a lot in that movie. Explorers, Daryl. I mean, all of these are really like very exciting, like for kids and teenagers, you know what I mean?
Well, and a lot of them didn't talk down to kids. I mean,
no, these are like real movies.
Yeah.
And when I say real movies, I mean like it isn't like, you know,
they're movies you can watch now as an adult and still enjoy.
Right. It's not like watching like Ghost Dad or something.
Well, like no one watches Ghost Dad. That's a really weird pull.
Or Beethoven. I mean, come on.
There you go. Beethoven's probably a better example. Yeah. Or like Clifford.
Yeah, Clifford. You know? Yeah.
But yeah. So I agree with you. I think these movies have substance to them. I think is what you're trying to say.
Yes.
They have some emotional and dramatic weight to them.
Yeah.
And that means you can revisit them and find new nuance in them. So I think there's a lot of great stuff that came out this year. It's not the strongest year of the 1980s. Obviously, that's probably the year before, which we covered last time.
We already kind of covered it. I mean, you had like Karate Kid and what were some of those other movies? I mean, Ghostbusters.
Oh, Ghostbusters, yeah.
Yeah.
But you're still getting like some echoes of good stuff in 85. And these movies definitely had a huge part that led to this nostalgia wave that our generation is so obsessed with.
Mm-hmm.
Like our generation is really heavily obsessed with the 80s nostalgia. And so much of it is not just 1984, but also the stuff in 1985 as well.
Yeah, it's completely true. And I don't even have the list. Let me just pull up the list right quick, okay? Just bear with me for a second while I fiddle with the internet here. Just to go over the top 10 in 1984, it was Ghostbusters, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, Gremlins, Star Trek III, The Karate Kid, The Natural, Purple Rain, Breakin', Bachelor Party, and Romancing the Stone. But I mean, also in there, you had Revenge of the Nerds. You had The Last Starfighter, The Neverending Story, Cloak and Dagger.
Like, even those little movies are movies that are kind of important to pop culture nerds like you and me, and I'm sure a lot of the people who listen to this show, you know?
This is Spinal Tap. Cheech and Chong's Karate Brother. Chud. You know, those kind of things. I mean, both those years, I mean, really 84, 85, it's really hard to find another, but to me, the sheer amount of movies that catered, to that age group, was absolutely amazing. And I think that, you know, to me, I think Daryl, like those movies that you haven't seen, I can't believe you haven't seen Daryl, is great. We ought to pair that one with Starman. That one's also really good.
That's Rary's a good idea.
Kind of similar.
I do love Starman. So that's a movie I've seen many times and would love to revisit, to get that lighter side of Carpenter and to talk more about, you know, of course, the great Jeff Bridges.
Yeah.
I'd be all for that.
And I think they kind of have similar storylines, but I don't want to talk too much about that, but I don't know. I don't know what else to say to wrap up 1985 other than that. Then it was a great time to be, you know, kids of our age, I think, at that time. Because I don't know how many times that I've seen some of these movies over and over, like Daryl, like St. Elmo's Fire, like Teen Wolf, like Summer Rental, you know, and just over and over and over again.
Well, and I think it's important to, I think a good way to put a cap on it is to say even the movies that seemed minor at the time had really long-lasting effects on our taste as viewers and the things that we enjoy. And I mean, it really influenced our taste in pop culture. And the things we look back on fondly, like some of them weren't very big movies. Better Off Dead is a perfect example of a movie that you and I both think very highly of that was, you know, kind of nothing at the time it came out. Mm-hmm. So I think it's one reason
barely a blip in the pop culture reference, you know, at the time period, but now has like huge like lasting ripple effects, especially within like you said in kids and people of our age group, I think.
Yeah, and so that's one thing that's great about the show and the whole kind of scene that we're part of, which is kind of just looking back at films from our youth and before. It allows us to reevaluate and reappreciate things that weren't treasured and loved at the time when they were created. Now we get to revere them and hold them up and say, "Hey, check this thing out. This thing is really cool."
Mm-hmm.
And I think this episode really reminded me of all these little minor things that, you know, again, weren't really revered then, but we revere them now. And it's always neat to me to go back and see how things kind of grow in esteem.
Yeah.
Over the years.
Yeah, kind of see that path, like, sort of developed how we got, you know, to now. I always think that we, you know, we just eschew so much media that, you know, it's easy to miss a lot of those things. I think that there, you know, this happens a lot in music where artists kind of get overlooked or songs from other artists get overlooked because we're just, you know, the culture is too busy eschewing the number one hits over and over. There's hardly any room for any other, you know, song to come forward. I mean, I don't know how many, like, I think like, you know, Fleetwood Mac had like two or three, like number two hits, you know what I mean? And it's just like, we're just so busy. I mean, in almost every song off of Rumors, could be a number one hit, in my opinion, and only one of them actually ever made it to number one. And so, yeah, I think that and now, you know, we're having like a resurgence of people discovering Fleetwood Mac for the first time, you know, because some guy made this really cool TikTok video. And that's the great thing about it. You know what I mean? Like a lot of people discovered, you know, Queen in the 1980s because of Wayne's World. And, you know, hopefully that some of you will be inspired and go back and watch some of these other movies that, you know, that we know are kind of popular, again, because of, you know, sort of 80s nostalgia, but also because of, you know, these other, the other movies that, that don't get talked about a lot. So,
well, and also, even if you're really into movies, as I'm an example of, you haven't seen everything. There are things we talked about on the show that I haven't seen. So it's going to inspire me to go back and rewatch things to fill in some gaps in my knowledge. And we hope that it'll do the same for you, or your listeners, to inspire you to go back and say, hey, I've never seen, you know, Silverado, or I've never seen, you know, Daryl, or, you know, one of those kind of films. And hopefully you'll go back and watch them and see why, after all these years, you know, we think they're worth talking about.
Yeah. And I love, you know, these movies that I've seen over and over, or I've seen before and you haven't seen. I'm always like really surprised. But like you said, there's just not enough time in the day, you know, and to watch everything. So, you know.
Well, and sometimes things will miss you by. You like, you get into one scene and you watch a lot of one thing, or you listen to a lot of one kind of music. You miss other things. It's just, that's natural, you know, because again, you just, human beings can't absorb everything all at once. And one thing that's very culturally important to me is not necessarily something that ever came into your radar when you were a kid, and that's vice versa. And that's one reason why it's fun to get together and chat about this stuff, because we can kind of be like, hey, you've never seen this, I've never seen that, let's go watch that.
Yeah.
And I think that's a great way to end it as for this episode, as this kind of, you know, one-off sort of divergent from our regular format. But, you know, we're going to be back in 2 weeks to have a double feature. We haven't quite decided what that double feature is going to be yet, but in 2 weeks...
it'll be good, I'm sure. I mean,
well, we've got a lot of possibilities. We just haven't narrowed it down.
I mean, but like you said, there's so many choices. There's so many things that we could do.
Exactly.
Yeah, there's just so many paths forward, and so many great, you know, great movies that were created. These movies were created to be watched. So hopefully we can watch them and share them and talk about them, and hopefully you enjoy that too. So thanks very much for listening to this episode. And I'm Ryan Acri.
And I'm Matthew Esri. Go watch some movies, guys.
Thanks for checking out this episode of Video Culture. You can check us out on Twitter at Video Culture 2.
That's the number 2 for two guys talking about movies like Ryan and myself.
And you can also check us out on Facebook. Just search for Video Culture Podcast.
Also, be sure to stop by our official website, video-culture.com. There we have the entire show archives, as well as articles about film.
Yeah, so check us out. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, coming out with us, talk movies. Did you like the show? Do you hate the show? Do you like or hate the movies we talked about? Let us know. Come chat with us, and let's all watch movies together.
The summer season's big crop of movies opens today. The Return of the Living Dead, American Flyers, Year of the Dragon, Volunteers, and The Bride. Entertainment Tonight surveyed several hundred people on the want-to-see potential for two of the new movies opening today. Any film scoring over 100 stands a chance for a good opening weekend box office. They won't have to draft anyone to see Volunteers. It scored 124 and shapes up to be the last strong summer box office movie despite mediocre reviews. However, the news is not so good for The Bride. There won't be many people walking down the aisles. The Bride scored a want-to-see of only 51. It'll be a brief honeymoon.
Can the craft of filmmaking outweigh the content of a film? Leonard Maltin answers that question in his review of Michael Cimino's first film since his disastrous Heaven's Gate 5 years ago.
There are two ways to look at a movie, emotionally and intellectually. A really great movie grabs you on both levels. Now, I don't think Michael Cimino's Year of the Dragon is a great movie, but it sure got to me on a gut level. I was riveted to the screen. This is the story of a cop who's obsessed with breaking the chain of corruption in New York's Chinatown.
You think gambling, extortion, corruption are kosher? Because it's 1,000 years old? This is America you're living in, and it's 200 years old, so you better get your clocks fixed. You're not special, and you're not beyond the law any more than the Puerto Ricans or the Polacks.
Mickey Rourke is obsessed. and he draws other characters into his madness, including a TV reporter to whom he's attracted, and the young Tsar of Chinatown, played by John Lone. But the source of Rourke's obsession lies far from Chinatown.
You're fighting the whole world all the time. I'm sick and tired of Vietnam as an excuse for everything you guys do.
Remember, it was Michael Cimino who painted that picture of Vietnam as living hell in The Deer Hunter. Well, this film is a continuation of the same story. Only the setting has changed. It has the same violence, the same intensity, and I had the same knots in my stomach. But then it just gets out of hand. The violence escalates, and so does the unbelievability. When it's all over, I don't know what point it was trying to make. And yet, as sheer movie-making, I found it electrifying. So, if you're curious, adventurous, and have a strong stomach, I recommend Year of the Dragon. I didn't always like it, but I did find it fascinating. So I'm going to give it a 7. I'm Leonard Maltin, Entertainment Tonight.
And before you head out to see a summer movie this weekend, here's a look at how Leonard rated some of the other films playing in movie houses around the country.